On ABC Radio,
this is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard another episode of The Big Fish. And our first cast this morning is out in the wilds of the Central West at the Winburn Dale Dam for the great Winburn Dale Trout Muster. And Luke Wong is there. Luke Wong from Landline on the ABC. Welcome aboard.
Hey, how you going, Scott?
Yeah, going really well. I think you've learnt one thing. The trout live in very cold climate.
Oh, indeed. Certainly with the weather that we've experienced in the central west of New South Wales this week. I've really experienced that. Well, the trout and also the Macquarie perch that are in this area now are loving the cold climate. And that's exactly what we've been looking at this week.
This is a great story. It's a place where fisher folk aren't allowed to go, Winburn Dale Dam. It's a water catchment that's protected. But in some ways, the trout that are in there, even though they're feral, we do love them. They're like the Brumbies of the high country, but we need to relocate them to safer, greener pastures so the natives have a chance. So take us through the story. It's a great story, the great Winburn Dale Trout Muster.
Yeah, look, this is really important work that the New South Wales DPI Fisheries are getting local anglers on board to help out with. It's important work to actually relocate those brown trout from Winburn Dale and the Macquarie River, but mostly in Winburn Dale, and to actually get them over to other places so that it gives the Macquarie perch that were reintroduced back into that area, re-established last year, just with the help of some special technology with their breeding. So DPI Fisheries have put in these Macquarie perch fries, but they need to kind of help get them along just a little bit because they're so small. They're kind of, they're being predated by these other bigger fish. And so they've had to move some of the brown trout to other locations just to give them a bit of a fighting chance. And so they've kind of, called on a bit of a help from groups like the Central Acclimatization Society. And they're really, coming on board to really just kind of catch those trout and get them to another place where they can also be accessed by fishers. Because this area that we've gone to, Winburn Dale, it's a water source for the city of Bathurst. And so there's no public access. And so even if there are, those beautiful brown trouts down there, you can't even catch them because it's not legal down there. But so they're trying to put them to a source where people can actually access them.
That's a great idea, isn't it? So they weren't allowed to be caught, but they are good to have in catchments. They're in Warragamba as well over the range, and they're a canary in the coal mine. Trout need very clear, unpolluted water, and that's what we want to drink as well. But getting them out of there, it wouldn't be that easy. How did they go about it? Because when we talk about relocating the Brumbies of the high country, we think of people in big hats, 10-gallon hats with ropes and lassos. How do you lasso a slippery trout, Luke Wong?
Yeah, well, so DPI Fisheries have been using a bit of electrofishing techniques, using these. So they go out on a bit of a boat with these two anodes that hang over the sides of the front. So these anodes, they look like kind of creepy crawlies. Like they've got these dangling wires that hang from these rotating objects at the front. And so they get dipped down into the water. Two of these anodes get dipped down into the water. And the fisheries people will be, they'll go along and they'll turn on these electrodes and they'll just stun the fish and catch them with the net and bring them up into the boat. And so the fish are fine. They're just stunned a little bit. And so it's just a matter of just going around the dam or the riverlet and doing this so that they can actually just...
The taser principle, Luke.
Yeah, pretty much. It's a bit of a taser. Yeah, that's right. And I was quite amazed. I've never seen it before. And there's also... You can also... So if that's not possible... So that's just one way. Then you can also put on a backpack as well. It's like pretty much a backpack with a massive car battery.
You'd look a bit like the Ghostbusters, would you?
Yeah, it's pretty big, and I think it probably weighs quite a bit as well. And so that in itself, so the operator has to put on some something so they can actually go in, waist deep into the water.
So rubber pants are essential, Luke. I hope they gave you a pair.
No. So I didn't step into the water. And I think they kind of warned me that, if you do go into the water and they've got the electrodes going, you make sure that you've fathered all your children already. So
no sporting for you down the track.
so they chuck on the chest waders, they put on the electro backpack, and then they go into the riverlet. And so they wade around and they can, they stick this anode, and it's kind of similar too. It looks like a upside down basketball hoop. And they put it into the water and they just stun the fish and they catch them with the nets. But so the day that I went there, unfortunately, there was a big storm the night before. And so the water in the riverlet was actually quite murky. And so it was very difficult to actually see any of the young, of the fingerlings of the brown trout. But the night before, it was crystal clear before the storm came, and the members from the Central Acclimatization Society were actually spotlighting the trout as they were going up the river, and they were just catching them with their nets, because they were just kind of swimming around there, just being happy there, and they just caught them up with their nets rather than having to do any of the stunning.
And I must say, they are a very reputable bunch of fisher folk, those women and men in that Central Acclimatization, Don Barton, Ray Tang. They would fly fishermen. They would never use these nefarious methods, but they're doing it for the good of the waterway. Could anyone remember what it was like when there were Macquarie perch in this system? Because this is quite symbolic, isn't it, that Macquarie perch are going back into the Macquarie River.
Yeah, look, it's been a long time since Macquarie perch were actually legally, you could actually fish for them legally because their numbers were actually, strong. But yeah, it's been a long time since that happened. I think it was probably maybe from the 90s, I think it was banned. But Central Acclimatization Society Secretary John Barton told me that, he remembers what it was like to actually fish for the Macquarie perch back in the day when it was not only legal but possible.
Up to about the late 80s, you had a reasonable chance of picking up a Macquarie perch, and they were a very exciting fish to catch. They're a bit like an Australian bass for people who've pursued those. They're an ambush predator, and they're very aggressive feeders. They'll really attack a lure or a fly much more vigorously than a trout will, so much so that if you've got a couple of Macquarie perch in a pool and half a dozen trout, you won't get any trout till you've caught both the Macquarie perch, because they beat the trout to the lure every time. So, yeah, fine sporting fish, wonderful fish to catch. And it was a real shock to see them just die off so quickly. And that was mostly due to the English perch being illegally released in rivers and streams and spread around the state in a way that was very damaging for both trout and Macquarie perch. Well, I used to catch them in Rocky Bridge Creek, and that's a tributary of the Wangler that lies between roughly Trunkie Creek and Neville. But people have caught them in the upper Macquarie in the past. They've caught them in creeks like this one beside us here, Wimbendale Rivulet. They were reasonably common. And if we actually go back another 50 years before my experience with them, they were very common. Their numbers in a river like, even Rocky Bridge, they would have been in the 100 weight per kilometre of stream in their numbers. They were so prolific, but deterioration in habitat with poor land management, alluvial gold mining in the 19th century really knocked them around, as it did with a lot of native fish. And the effect of the things like alluvial gold mining is it mobilises silt in the stream, so the deep refuge holes they need to see out the warm months of the year when the water might be too hot even for native fish, those refuge holes fill up, so there are no cold deep holes for these fish to survive in. And it also smothers the spawning beds they need, the nice, clear, cobbly riffles that get them primed for their spawning runs and activities, yeah. Well, I think the work we're doing is worthwhile, because I think we're showing other recreational fishermen and women that the issue between fish like trout and Macquarie perch is not necessarily one of conflict. By working sensibly with the conservation people in fisheries, just as we are today, you can get a win-win for both the recreational fishery and for the endangered species. And that's got to be a good thing. I think fishing and the fishery is a much more intelligent area than with respect to animals, the marsupials and so on, because you tend to get a kind of knock-down and drag-out mentality on both sides of the debate there. And I think there'd be much better results if there are more people trying to work together with conservation issues generally.
It's The Big Fish, and Luke Wong has been in the bush at Winburn Dale Rivulet and Dam, which is a no-fishing zone. It's a catchment for the beautiful city of Bathurst. But Luke, people like Don can remember catching them, and he's only a young bloke. I mean, wouldn't it be marvellous if one day you and I, we can go out and cast a fly or a lure and have one? And apparently they are really amazing. They pull a trout backwards. They're beautiful eating fish, but it's going to be a while before we can do that, although we might see it in our lifetime. Is that the hope from people like fishery scientist Luke Pearce?
Yeah, that's right. And both Don and Luke, you know, they've got this great hope that in their lifetime they'll be able to just improve the Macquarie Perch's numbers in these catchments. And really, it's something, it's quite, I guess, heartening to see that they're putting in all this work and they're trying to leave it for, I guess, their children and their grandchildren so that they can enjoy fishing for the Macquarie Perch. You know, once again, this is something that hasn't happened for a long time. And so, you know, they're really putting in some hard yards to get this happening. But yeah, DPI Fisheries Manager Luke Pearce says it's really important work, and just getting the local anglers on board to help with the relocation of the trout is really vital.
It's vital in terms of giving them the best chance we can to establish. So the Macquarie Perch potentially would establish here and can coexist with trout and do coexist with trout in some locations. But what we want to do is we want to give them the best chance we can of establishing, and that means reducing the numbers of trout here to make more food and resources available for them. So, I think it's really important, particularly in these early stages when the fish are small and we're trying to get them established, is to reduce that competition and give them the best chance we can. So we're moving the trout from this system across to some lakes at Portland, which is only just down the road. They're actually disused quarries from the old cement works at Portland, and this is a great little spot where the community is trying to establish a fishery for the local community to come and catch fish, and people are coming from all around now to try and catch trout out of those ponds. It's a great area that has, you know, really good access and right in the middle of town pretty much, and it's a great area where the local kids and the local community can come and catch these fish and enjoy them. Macquarie perch are extremely threatened. Here in New South Wales now, we've got four really small isolated populations left remaining across the whole state, four populations left. Each of those populations is continuing to decline at the moment and in real threat of becoming extinct or being lost. And, you know, unless we continue to do things like we're doing here today and continue to try and, you know, recover and rebuild those populations, you know, without this kind of activity, I could really envisage that Macquarie perch could easily become extinct in my lifetime.
How important is it to actually get local anglers involved in this relocation?
Yeah, look, it's vital. You know, if we don't have the support of local anglers, you know, we're not going to be able to undertake these kind of activities. You know, it's really important that they support, you know, us relocating the trout, but really support and get behind, you know, the re-establishment of Macquarie perch. Like, historically, Macquarie perch were really widespread, super abundant, really regarded as a really great angling and table species, and, you know, really revered. And we want to see them come back to being, you know, being back on the table or back on the target list for recreational anglers one day and being able to enjoy them again like they used to do historically. So, you know, we really need their support to drive this and get behind it and really give us a hand and promote what we're doing as well.
Fishery scientist Luke Pearce there speaking with Luke Wong. Out in the wilds, I could hear your teeth chattering, Luke. It was very cold and snow on the ground in places too. But this can be done. I really have great faith and confidence in these guys into the future. People like Stuart Rowland and others at Narandra and on the river at Grafton, who brought back endangered species. The trout cod, there were less trout cod in our rivers in New South Wales than there are Macquarie perch. That's how bad they were going. And now if you go between Wagga and up towards Gundagai in the river, you're guaranteed almost to catch one. You can't keep them because they're still protected, but their numbers have bounced back because they've worked out the breeding conundrum, how to stimulate them with artificial hormones in the hatchery situation. And they've used the Sunshine Coast University and a fantastic gene mapping technology and the fisheries people at Narandra, and they're right on the cusp of breeding them in big numbers, Luke Wong, and that's very exciting, isn't it?
That is, yeah, that hormone inducement therapy developed by the University of Sunshine Coast is pretty amazing, and it's all happening out of that Narrandera site of DPI. And really, I guess when you see the comparison of like the size of the brown trout that they were catching over at Wimberndale compared to the Macquarie perch, you could see that, well, you know, these yeah. trout would just gobble them up if they just had the chance, because the Macquarie perch take years to kind of really develop and mature. It takes, I think Luke was saying, it was about 4 or 5 years until they get to a decent size. Mm-hmm. And he was showing me the odd little fry that he'd pulled up, and it was just tiny, just a couple of centimeters, and compared to the brown trout that they were pulling up, which were like, I don't know,
what
about 45
like?
Centimeters.
What was that like? I know you've got a bit of a taste for the fishing since I took you on that fishing adventure with the Tiwi Island guide from the Northern Territory. And
Sydney Harbour, that was great.
That was good fun. Yes, we do have some fishing adventures. I wish I was out there with you on this one out in the bush. But what's it like when the big brown trout surfaces from the murky water with the electrofishing? That must bring a gasp or two.
Mate, these were big. They were pulling out some that were like, you know, about 45 centimetres. They were about 4 pounds. And they took about, I think, 8 of those over from the Bathurst side over to the Portland side, and around about 40 or 50 smaller ones that were just, you know, fingerlings, like about 100 millimetres or so. So, you know, you could see that the Macquarie perch were really, there was a lot of competition, I guess, if they were up against those kind of big boys.
The thing about these brown trout too, they've been here for so long, since 1864, that they've acclimatised. They really have worked out how to live in a very dry, hot climate. So our trout and their genetics are very pure compared to the rest of the world, because these fish have just survived. So I guess a lot of people would say, even though they're feral, they have a right to survive. And when they're translocated to those fishing ponds for the people of Bathurst, I think it's going to be great to catch one of those. I can see where you're going.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, it's about access as well, giving anglers the access to actually get to these fish that normally they wouldn't be able to actually get to. And so, you know, being able to just go to Portland, I think these little ponds, Luke was mentioning that they're in the middle of the town, you know, so how easy is it going to be, and how good is it going to be for places like Portland that is just in between Bathurst and Lithgow? You know, you could just rock up and, you know, throw your line in and hopefully catch a brown trout. And so, you know, the more that they put in there, that I guess the better chance that you'll have as well.
Yeah, I think it's just put Portland on the map as a trophy trout fishing destination. It's a great story. It's an absolute win-win. And Luke, I know you'll be following it for Landline, doing great work there. I saw you up at the apple orchards in Batlow the other day tasting the cider. It's a tough gig, mate, but someone's got to do it.
That's right. I don't think there's much to be... well, let's just put it this way. It's quite an enviable job, I think. You know, I do get to sample some great stuff and see some amazing places, so it is a wonderful thing. But yeah, I think with this story, we'll be following it for a long time, because the next time that they'll be doing this hormone inducement therapy will be, I guess, in October, and then the next release of these of the Macquarie perch will maybe be early next year or late this year. So it's a long kind of road to actually get these types of stories done.
And they always tend to send you to the alpine locations. You're a tough guy, Luke. They send you to the mountains, to the snow, Batlow.
Yeah, I guess, well, you know, living in Orange, I guess they think, well, this guy can handle the cold, whereas I think all the reporters up in Queensland or the Northern Territory, yeah, just let them stick with the hot weather.
Very soft. Very soft, Luke. Tight lines to you, mate. We'll have to go fishing again, and you've had some good fun there at the great Wimberndale Trout Muster.
Yes, it's been fantastic. Thank you.
Folk singing, guitar playing girl. gotta slow down. I wanna walk that highway, yeah. With you, 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 you. Oh, yeah. Second hand dealing, boy, I'm gonna love him the best way I can. I know I can. Cause I'm a country girl in a city whirlpool, and I'm pulling over, man. I'm gonna let you through. I'm living in the left hand lane of my city. Golden, but don't like pearls. I'm just your regular West Australian fisherman's daughter. I'm a middle class folk singing guitar playing girl.
Coming up on The Big Fish, Stinker has had one perfect day on the water, including the biggest sea creature he's ever seen out of the water. And Craig McGill has had a great day as well. His best fishing day of his life with some Aboriginal boys from Wingham and Dubbo who found out firsthand how to be a great, successful fishing guide with the master, Captain McGill. All coming up on The Big Fish.
She sits on a dock of fishing in the water. I don't know her name, she's a fisherman's daughter, Come on down to my boat, baby. Come on down where we can play. Come on down to my boat, baby. Come on down, we'll sail away.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Stinker with his fishing tips, some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find him? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
I tell you what, that Nelson Bay, Port Stephens area, they owe you a dollar or two for the way you talk the place up. You love the place, and you took a tour group out the other day, and I believe it really turned it on. It was the greatest trip you've ever had.
It was a 10 out of 10, Scott. A 10 out of 10. When Port Stephens gets everything right, it is just the most beautiful place. It's got the most fantastic islands and beaches. Ah, and the headlands, Yacka Bar and Tomaroo, which are the towering headlands at the entrance to Port Stephens, they're so majestic and big. They're big. and beautiful and all.
They're old volcanoes, aren't they, Stinker?
Oh, there's something to do with the volcanic period, yes. There's a lot of geology. Any geologist would have an absolute picnic at this up here. But it was Wednesday, Scott, that I took a group out. We left the harbour, left the marina at around about 10 o'clock, and off we went in absolutely perfect conditions. When the port was just flat, it was as flat as a flounder, and there was not a cloud in the sky and not a breath of air. I mean, I'm painting a picture here, and it is just, it was this good. So off we go. We get halfway to the entrance to the port, and we're joined by a big pot of maybe 20 bottlenose dolphins. And Port Stephens is known for dolphins, and we reckon with us between 90 and 100 permanent resident dolphins at any one time. So they escorted us to under the shadows of Yakabar Head, which is North Head. And Yakabar is quite extraordinary. It's wilderness. It's a wilderness in there. There's absolutely nothing that man has made. It's just like it was centuries ago, I should think. But underneath it, I find very interesting because it is the richest lobster country that you could ever possibly imagine. And it seems to go most of the year, Scott.
Have you set your pots? Because the winter time is it. Are you getting out into it?
Well, I set a trap. You're allowed one trap and two lobsters a day. So I'm in cahoots with a mate down the road. He's got a trap. So the two of us go out in stink pot and we put one trap for him and one trap for me. And you're a permitted two lobsters each. But I go off Fingal, which is quite a distance from Yakabar. But Yakabar, sometimes there can be 50 to 80 traps at Yakabar. And I've had three reports this fortnight about a great white shark is lingering around there. So that's got everybody on high alert, because a couple of times after a big sea, the float on your lobster trap will be pulled under. And your trap is still there, but because there's no float on the surface, you've got to get a diver to go down and see if you can find, untangle the line.
Are you advertising for that position at the moment, no. Stinker? Is anyone out there willing to have a look for you with the great white hanging around?
No one. You can put an ad in the paper and no one will reply. So we left Yakabar. We left Yakabar, and then the dolphins sort of peeled off and went back into the port. They were right under the bow, so all those on board were just looking straight down as the dolphins were directly under us. But then we went across to Cabbage Tree Island. Now, Cabbage Tree Island is the closest island when you leave the port, and it has its own personality as well, with those beautiful cabbage tree palms on the western face. Every island here, Scott, has its own personality and very different. They're all very different.
That one is a great bait spot too. I don't know if it's still allowed, but the game fishers particularly get their livies there, don't they?
That's right. That's right. And that's all you can catch there. And so you can pull up there, and then you can catch slimy mackerel. There's heaps, always heaps and heaps of slimy mackerel there, or yellowtail or garfish, and that's it. You can't catch anything else. So if you're catching bait and you just happen to hook a big snapper on your bait line, well, hard luck. You've got to let him go because it's a sanctuary zone. But that's also the home of the Gould's petrel, which we've mentioned on this program before, is the bird that was endangered, very, very close to extinction because the eggs were being attacked by crows and currawongs. Do you remember me telling you that?
Yeah, I do. I do. And what was the solution again?
Well, there were rabbits on the island, and the rabbits were chewing the undergrowth, which expose the eggs, because the Gould's petrel lays their eggs on the ground, not up in a tree, but on the ground. So they need that ground cover to protect them from any predatory bird. But unfortunately, it was taken away by the rabbits. So first step by a National Parks and Wildlife ranger by the name of Nicholas Carlisle, who did an extraordinarily good job and lived on that island. Remember, because it's a very steep island, so he lived like a mountain goat on the island until he solved the problem. So he got rid of the rats, then he got rid of the crows and the currawongs, then the undergrowth returned, which covered the eggs, and then the birds started to regather their population. But Suzanne Callaghan, who also works with National Park, what she did, she then set up nests. She built nests for the little bird on two other islands, Bundaberg Island and Broughton Island, so that if any tragedy occurred on Cabbage Tree Island, like a fire, then there were still colonies on other islands. So we went, we saw all that in the boat, in the big boat. We went right in really, really close to Cabbage Tree. And, like, the water was gin clear. You could see pebbles on the bottom in 30-foot of water. Oh, wow. Just beautiful. And around the corner on the northern face was a colony of seals. So we dropped in and saw them for a while. They're fascinating creatures.
They're going to expect this every time because it's you're at the whim of nature, aren't you?
Oh, you know, there's so many things that you can miss out on, but this particular trip we went on, we got the whole box and dice, and even looked like the seals put on the performance for us. So they jumped in and swam around and crawled around on the rocks and sunned themselves and carried on. And then we left Cabbage Tree and headed direct north to Broughton. Well, the whales, fair dinkum. Oh, the whales were everywhere. And they're really getting quite friendly, which might be a bit scary if you're in a small boat. But I think we saw probably 30-odd whales, I guess. One lady from Pacific Palms, oh, Margaret, she got the photo of all photos, which I'll send to you. And you can maybe put it up, show the other people.
Yeah, we will. We'll put it up with the podcast for sure, show people. And what did she capture?
Well, we were just sort of looking at the whales, and they were taking it easy, nothing spectacular, a bit of tail flapping and all that. And the noise when they breathe out is quite an extraordinary noise of all that expulsion of air. But then out of nowhere, the whale just leapt out of the ocean entirely, like 100% of the whale out of the water. Well, that is something to see within 50 metres of the boat. That is really something to see.
They must have to go down right to the bottom to get the speed up, to get that massive body out of the water, stinker.
Well, I thought about that, Scott. I mean, how much energy would it be required to launch a creature that big and that heavy totally out of the water? I mean, that's a fair effort, isn't it?
I have trouble getting out of the bath, stinker, let alone doing that.
Well, that got everybody on edge. But there was still one thing that I was hoping people would see, and that's my favourite of all, and that is I love the sea eagles. I'm a real sea eagle. I love them. I think they're the most wonderful bird, and they're the top of the tree, so to speak. And we hadn't seen one. We hadn't seen a seagull until we got to the Looking Glass on Broughton Island. And the Looking Glass is a strange, huge outcrop with a crack through it that you can actually motor through, which I have motored right through the middle of this rock. But on top of the rock, there's a nest. Well, the mother bird, I'm assuming it was the mother bird, had two younger birds, and she was teaching them how to hunt. And we just watched it. We were mesmerised by these three sea eagles and what they got up to. It was just so entertaining. And it was like a billiard table. The whole, you know, it was just, and so blue and crystal. And then, of course, we got onto the island and we walked across the island, and then we could look at a place called Coalshaft, which then you look back towards Nelson Bay and you see all the outline of the Bulahdelah mountain ranges and the magnificent beach from Hawk's Nest Beach right through to Seal Rocks. It just takes your breath away. And then we left Coalshaft and walked over to what's called Providence Beach or North Beach, where the Greeks lived during at the First World War right through to the 1930s. They had a little colony there, Greek lobstermen. They're long gone. But the scenery there right through to Seal Rock, wow. And we got back on the boat, and then a northerly wind kicked in and blew us home. So I'm thinking, yeah, oh, that's right. And just about as we were to enter the port, where the dolphins were waiting for us again, four jets from the local RAF base at Williamtown roared down. And I'm thinking, as if to say, you've had a good day, haven't you?
And did you tell them you organised that stinker?
Yeah. I organised all the whales and the dolphins and the sea eagles and the RAF base. Yeah, I got all that.
This is a fishing show, you know, stinker. I mean,
yeah.
did they put you on a ban when you do the tourist boat not to bring your fishing gear?
Oh, look, they're funny, these fellas, the young blokes that run the boat, because when I take over and tell the people the history of the island, they take off in their boat, and I reckon they've got some plastics on board, so they do a bit of fishing while I entertain the crowd, basically. And it's a real, this is snapper season, Scott. This is snapper season. And like I said, last week I got some beautiful fish, and it's time for me to go again. But the weather is, I don't think it'll be until about next Tuesday before I can get back out on the water, because it's just a bit wild and woolly.
They're saying we could get some really big seas building.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk 5, 6, 7 metre sea, we're talking big sea, really big thunderous sea, which is absolutely impossible. You just don't even consider boating outside the heads.
If you can get out in the calm before the big seas to put the lobster traps in, or the one that you're allowed, you'll go all right.
Well, there's only one problem there, and that is the angle that the sea hits with. If it comes in at an angle that really, and it only needs a few degrees of change, and then your lobster trap can end up at Port Macquarie.
Or you caught a fox in one once. Was that you or one of your mates?
Yeah, that's right. One of the Glenny Tarrant, one of his traps washed up into the Bidu bush, and when he went to get it, he jumped out of his boat and climbed up the rocks, and there was a fox. He'd gone on.
Inside the trap.
Glenny Tarrant tells me some great stories, and sometimes I don't know whether to believe
is that,
or not.
Is that fair dinkum?
Look, I don't know. I wasn't there to see the fox.
I reckon it is. I reckon it could happen.
It's possible. And that's what makes you think. He's a character. This man's been a fisherman all his life, and he's a fantastic fisherman. He's a commercial fisherman, and he hasn't been real well lately. But any time I need cheering up, I'll go and sit down while he's making his traps or mending his net, and I'll just go and sit on a milk crate, and then off he goes. And, oh, he knows. He knows he makes me laugh, you know. So he tells me. And I don't care whether his stories are true or not. I don't give two hoots. He's very entertaining.
Good fun. Hey, Stinker, tight lines, and thanks for sharing your perfect day on the water.
Hooray, Scott.
And not a fish caught.
We didn't even try.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Craig McGill, Sydney Fishing Guide, you've had the trip from heaven. You've had a great week. Tell us all about the Aboriginal kids who you took out this week.
Good day, mate. Yeah. No, look, we had a fantastic trip. I'm involved with an organisation called the Shoreline Group, and what they do is they sort of try and play. It's a charity organisation. They try and place young Indigenous kids into the workplace, and primarily in things like fishing guiding and you know, outdoor activities. So, you know, a lot of them go and get their coxswain's ticket so they can drive a boat or that sort of stuff, but mostly outdoors-based type stuff. So we had a couple of the kids from Joey's school out during the week, and, mate, it couldn't have gone better. We just absolutely killed it. We got started off the morning. We went down and we got a tank load of massive squid, you know, those big ones that look like a stingray when they're coming up, you know?
Oh, I love them. Yes, boy.
Yeah, they're about 3 metres wide. Just unbelievable, you know?
And I've told you a billion times not to exaggerate, but I know that they're big. They are big at this time of year. They're beautiful.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The ones that drag men to their deaths.
Captain Nemo size.
Yeah. But, so we got a tank full of them, and then went up the river and pretty much into them straight away. Opened the account with a meadery. And then it just went on from there. We pulled in four over a metre. We lost a few big ones. We got some 90s. We got some 80s and 70s. Let most of them go, of course. We kept one or two fish for the table.
You'd be able to feed all the boarders at St. Joey's with one of those.
I'm telling you, they took a few kilos back with them. But, just an unbelievable day and such a good introduction. And the guy that organises it, a fellow by the name of Guy Reynolds, he runs the organisation. He rang me up and he said, "Geez, the boys, that's the best day of those boys' life." And he said, "You're lucky they don't have a boat because they'd be back there every day for the next."
How old are they?
Well, look, they were year 10. So what would they be?
About 15. Yeah, 15, 16.
Yep. One of the fellows was from Wingham, out the back of Tari. So they're boarders here in Joey's College, and one of them was from Wingham and the other one was from Dubbo. So, they just had an amazing day.
It's a long way from the Macquarie River, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And they love fishing? These lads love fishing?
Oh, absolutely loved it. And you know, going through the whole process of catching the squid, catching the fish, and then you know, I showed them how to kill the fish properly, so you do it quickly and humanely, and then bleeding them and preparing them, filleting them. So we did the whole process from you know, boat to table, and it was good, and got to show them that, you know, you let a few go as well. You don't have to keep everything, don't have to kill everything you catch. Just a great all round experience for the fellas.
That's a great harbour, isn't it? And such a contrast for a country lad or someone from the Tiwi Islands to be in that hustle and bustle and yet still catching trophy fish.
Exactly. Yeah. No, best harbour in the world. I haven't seen them all, but from what people tell me, I get a lot of tourists on my boat, and all of them say to me the same thing: "You got the best harbour in the world here."
And what did you do with the squid? Did you put them on whole or in live, or cut them up?
Well, when we first got there, we had a spread out, so we had a live one. We had some strips and some heads out, and they nailed the live one first. But then, as the bite went on, they just got down to taking pretty much anything, even the strips of the tube. So they really fired up to the point that where they were pretty much just eating anything. There's really only one way. You've got to get squid.
That's right. And these trips, oftentimes, you know, the squidding can take as long as it takes because you've got to get them.
Yes. Well,
it's not as if you're saying, well, we're going fishing for 4 hours. You might have to have a good hour and a half to get the squid.
Yeah, that's right. Look, one of the American presidents, Abraham Lincoln, he said, if you give me 4 hours to chop down a tree, I'll spend the first 3 hours sharpening the saw. And this is the same with the squid. I don't care if I've got to spend 4 hours catching squid, because that's what you have to do if you want to catch kingfish consistently. You can get your yakkers in 10 minutes, but you could then go and sit there all day and catch nothing. And I'm not interested in doing that. I want to catch the kingfish. So, yeah, that's, you know, what he said was you can apply to a lot of things, I think.
I'd be happy just to go squidding. It sounds like it's a good time to go squidding on Sydney Harbour. Where are some of the hot spots?
Oh, look, I love squidding. Some people find it boring, but most people I know really, really enjoy squidding. It's a good way to start the day. At the moment, they tend to be the biggest squid. So the deep kelp beds, so South Head, some of the deeper points around North Harbour, Middle Head, Nelson Park, any of those deep kelp beds. And I know that the boys going offshore are hitting them around the headlands too, sometimes as deep as 60 feet of water. I think pretty much the kelp has a limit, I think somewhere between 40 and 60 feet of water, and then it runs out of sunlight and it won't grow anymore. So that's sort of about your limit, you know, 50, 60 feet.
I like those really big heavy red jigs if you're in that really deep water. And you virtually just let them sink and just keep in touch with them, don't you? You don't do too much with them.
No, just and you can drift if the weather's good. You can drift along with those heavy jigs and just jig them on the spot. And what a lot of the guys do too now is rig them up on Paternoster rigs. So they'll have a heavy sinker down the bottom and a couple of droppers coming off and a squid jig on each dropper. And what I do, occasionally I'll use that technique in some spots in the harbour. What I do in that situation is I'll trim a lot of the lead off the jig itself. So you don't want, if you're going to use a Paternoster rig, you don't want the jig sinking back onto the line. Do you know what I mean? So you trim as much of the jig's lead off as you can just to get them to that point where they're sort of neutral buoyant. So they're just sort of hovering along as you drift. And even in the harbour sometimes, when I'm fishing some of the shallower beds, I'll do the same thing. I'll trim a little bit of lead off the jig. In fact, there's one technique we use where we drift over a fairly sandy patch where you've got a bit of ribbon weed here and there and we get a lot of cuttlefish and arrow squid. I'll actually run a sinker, a split shot sinker up ahead of the jig, and I'll trim most of the lead off the jig itself. So the jig sort of floats up behind the sinker, not too high, but you trim it so it's just sort of floating. And what that does is it allows you to keep contact with the bottom, but doesn't let the jig itself drag along the bottom, so you're not picking up the weed. And that's a very effective technique.
I think one of the things that works too, and sometimes you retrieve's different, but really less is more with retrieve. You just got to let it get down in around the kelp. They don't swim in the middle of the water column, do they? They need cover because they're eaten by everything. So they'll use their camouflage to look like a weed bed or a kelp bed or a rocky outcrop, and if you're just hovering your prawn jig down near them, then they'll come out and grab it. I've been out with you before, and people who fish a lot of lures will whip them in too fast. You've got to virtually fish them static.
Oh, it's got to hover within a metre of that kelp bed, which is sort of, you know, it's a fine line, because if you let it go too far, you're gonna get snagged.
A fantastic introduction to Sydney Harbour and to fishing and the possibilities of being guides too on their own country. It's really something that they could look into.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, they've got a good uptake with this program, and a lot of the boys have gone on into job placements in those sort of fields. So yeah, definitely I could.
Yeah, working for national parks or with their local Aboriginal land councils.
Yep.
As a cultural guide, it's happening all over the place. And their culture and stories are just priceless. The world loves this culture. It's one of the world's great cultures. And if these boys can be custodians of it, it's a wonderful thing. Well done. Yep. Tight lines to you.
Thanks, mate.
Saturday is a very fine day to do a little work in the yard. But when the sun is a-shining away, it makes the work too hard.
It makes the work too hard.
So
let's go fishing instead of just a wishing. What do you say we go away for a while?
Dig those worms out of the side.
Put them in a can and go get a rod.
Let's go fishing for a day and a half a mile.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.